Britain. Labour's first budget. Spend now, reform eventually. Rachel Reeves has raised both borrowing and taxes by historic amounts.
No one could argue the numbers in Britain's budget were too small. On October 30th, Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, laid out over £40 billion, that's $52 billion, in tax rises, more than any budget has raised in at least half a century. Borrowing went up too, as Reeves loosened the rules constraining borrowing to invest and then ran close to the limit of her newly generous yardstick. The result was a package of fiscal easing worth nearly 1% of GDP, an amount without much recent precedent outside recessions and pandemics. The Office for Budget Responsibility, or OBR, a fiscal watchdog, reckons that stimulus could push inflation up by 0.4 percentage points at peak and only durably boost growth after almost a decade. Gilts sold off sharply as financial markets absorbed the news. This is a big contrast with the steady-as-she-goes approach Ms. Reeves took before the election. Labour's manifesto contained only a few tax tweaks and spending bumps. Instead of raising taxes, the campaign patter ran, Labour would pull the growth lever. But although this was a big budget, it was not an ambitious one. Dialing up taxes and borrowing to inject money into the National Health Service, or NHS, is familiar for the Labour Party, even if the cash was sorely needed. Unfortunately, Ms. Reeves ducked the chance to make Britain's tax code more growth-friendly and in places even worsened it. She also mostly ignored the thorniest questions for Labour, such as how to ensure that an island full of ever older, ever sicker people does not force up taxes indefinitely. The centrepiece of the budget was an increase to employers' national insurance that the OBR expects to raise £26 billion, falling to £16 billion after it flows through to lower wages. As Reeves insists, unconvincingly, that the move does not run afoul of Labour's pre-election promises not to raise national insurance or taxes on working people. In practice, employers will gradually pass on the bulk of the tax rise to workers in the form of slower pay rises. Sermons from leading Tories on the economics of tax incidents are now all but inevitable. Setting aside the scholastic wrangling over broken promises, Ms. Reeves was at least right to achieve the bulk of her tax rises through a single, broad-based tax. But it would have been cleaner to have reversed cuts to national insurance made by her predecessor Jeremy Hunt. Using employers' national insurance raises the tax penalty on employment versus self-employment, a long-standing drag on productivity. Taxes on the wealthy, an area where Labour had made a lot of noise, will raise another few billion. Some changes ended up being gentler than expected, raising capital gains tax from 20% to 24%, shaving exemptions on inheritance tax and making the taxation of private equity performance fees a little less generous. But others were tougher, most notably the treatment of non-domiciled taxpayers. Months of grisly pre-budget speculation about plans to soak the rich may already have hurt Britain's reputation as a haven for footloose international capital. Most revealing were the steps that Labour did not take. On tax after tax, Ms. Reeves opted for easy fudges over ambitious reforms. On capital gains tax, she could have raised the same amount less painfully by shifting the tax base to affect gains only above a risk-free rate of return, but doing so at a higher rate, and by limiting exemptions. She went a little further on inheritance tax, but again, not far enough. One especially loud sigh of relief came in the AIM market, a tax-advantaged index of small-cap stocks which soared by over 4% after Ms. Reeves indicated that its inheritance tax exemptions would be watered down but not entirely eliminated. Fresh from a big election win, This would have been an ideal chance for Ms. Reeves to make big-ticket improvements. One natural place to look would have been stamp duty, a property transaction tax that is probably the single biggest growth blocker in Britain's tax system. Instead of cutting it, she raised it for second homes. Nor did Ms. Reeves touch taxes on gambling, which could have raised a few hundred million while deterring some unwise financial decisions. Now would have been a perfect time to revisit road taxes. Electric vehicles are spreading quickly and are not covered by fuel duties. Far easier to start taxing them now, before a vocal lobby of EV owners is in place to complain. But Ms. Reeves did nothing there, and, worse yet, continued her Tory predecessor's cowardly habit of freezing fuel duty. What of her spending choices? The biggest single beneficiary of all that extra tax revenue will be healthcare, which is set for a 3.4% real terms rise in its day-to-day budget over this fiscal year and the next. Education will also do well, getting a real terms increase of 3.5%. But the increase is at once too small and too large. It is unlikely to properly put the NHS back on an even keel. A 3-4% real terms increase is roughly in line with the historical norm, though above what was on offer in the years before the pandemic. But with GDP growth well below 2%, having a healthcare system that grows at twice the rate of the broader economy is also unsustainable. The critical question, then, is whether the government can work out how to stretch that money further. Beyond a few platitudes about finding efficiencies and harnessing technology, Ms. Reeves had little to say on that. The budget's plans for borrowing are almost as hefty as the tax hikes, around £30 billion more annually, enabled by a loosening of Britain's fiscal rules, something Ms. Reeves had committed before the election not to do. Instead of targeting a measure of government debt, her new rule targets public sector net financial liabilities, which offset government debt against some liquid assets like the student loan book. She has made other fiscal rule changes too, which are broadly sensible, shifting over time to target a 3-year forecast rather than a 5-year one. Reduces the scope for governments to pencil in dodgy long-term plans in the knowledge that they might not be in office when they bite. By ensuring that day-to-day spending is met without borrowing, Ms. Reeves has ruled out the prospect of Liz Truss-style unfunded tax cuts. Overall, there is a solid case for more borrowing. Britain's record on public investment has been feeble for decades. But as the market's reaction to the budget has shown, borrowed money is not free. Interest payments on government debt cost Britain 4.5% of GDP in 2023, more than double the defence budget. A front-loaded investment spree risks overheating the economy unless the spending is directed at the biggest supply-side constraints on Britain's growth, including transport and power infrastructure. The OBR sees a short-term inflation boost from the budget. A big round of public investment also cannot substitute for private investment. Indeed, it risks crowding it out. So Labour needs to supply investment that is well-directed, efficiently spent, and does not overheat the economy in the short term. The government is setting up a new body called the Office for Value for Money to oversee the spree. A 10-year infrastructure strategy is coming in the spring, but the British state's recent spending record on that count is hardly impressive. A splurge must also be accompanied by changes to the planning rules and the judicial review system, both of which get in the way of building. Across taxes, borrowing and spending, the government is betting big that tens of billions in extra NHS spending will make a difference, that Britain's workers and firms can bear ever higher taxes, that markets will support a big fiscal expansion. Those bets will come good only alongside equally ambitious reforms to the tax system, to public service provision, to the planning system, and more. On that, this heavyweight budget was alarmingly light.